Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It is high noon in Washington, D.C. This is the Horn, America's liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid. You know that. We are live at the America's Future Now conference at the Omni Shoreham Hotel, hosted by the Campaign for America's Future. This is day two of our live broadcast. And, of course, just a reminder, archives of the program, podcasts, etc., available at whiteRoseSociety.org/Kincaid.html. And a little bit of an experiment underway as well. We are also sending live video at the Horn's Ustream channel. That's ustream.tv. Just look for The Horn, the H-O-R-N, The Horn. And I see no reason why we shouldn't get right to business. We've got a very busy 3 hours slated ahead of us today, and we're starting it off with a gentleman whose conversations I have always enjoyed. Scott Paul joins us from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us today. I'm always glad to get an opportunity to talk to you and about the good work that the Alliance for American Manufacturing is doing. You've had a fairly busy day here today.
We did a panel this morning on making it in America, where we took a couple cuts at it. We looked at public opinion views on manufacturing and a better trade policy. Mark Melman, who's a very well-known pollster, he's done polling for guys like Dick Gephardt, but he does it for Harry Reid. He's done some for Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. Did some public opinion research on people's views on manufacturing and polling. Found very positive results. We heard from Clyde Prestowitz, who is a former Reagan administration trade official and Obama supporter, about how we need a new manufacturing and trade policy. And then we also heard from an expert from the Center for American Progress on clean energy manufacturing and how we're losing out to Germany, Spain, and China because we don't have the right policies in place.
We are, in effect, getting left in those countries' wakes right now, are we not?
Well, you bet. And the shame of it is, you know, after the oil crisis in the 70s, we put into place some incentives in the tax code for solar and for wind. And so America developed these technologies. I mean, we developed the photovoltaic cell solar technology. We invented the wind turbine. We made those things, believe it or not, back in the late 70s. But when the Reagan administration came in, those tax credits started going away for producing solar, for producing
everybody wind. Remembers how Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the top of the White House.
It's exactly right. But it's symbolic of what happened to the industry. So whereas you had dozens of factories that were making these things, by the end of the 80s and into the 90s, you had exactly one factory that was making wind turbines in the United States.
That's it?
Yeah, that's it. And you had virtually no solar production. And so you get to today, and we're trying to revive this kind of clean energy manufacturing base because, again, we've had, you know, dependence on Middle Eastern oil is a foreign
Indeed.
Policy problem. Fossil fuels are a big climate change challenge for us. And the recent BP spill obviously puts this into special focus. But we've looked at a clean energy economy again and producing clean energy, and we're dependent on other countries to do it now because we completely, even though we innovated it and we manufactured the first stuff, we let it go all offshore. So we get 70% of the value of wind turbines comes from other countries right now. Comes from not only China, but from Germany, from Spain, from Holland and other countries that make stuff, and it's simply because we have not focused on it.
And that and all of those clean energy industries, whether it be wind or solar or things related to hydro, those are all industries that could generate vast numbers of American jobs, are they not?
Well, exactly right. Two quick things that your listeners should know. You know, the Energy Department has looked at the types of quote unquote green jobs that would be created in a new clean energy economy. And 70% of the potential jobs in solar and in wind would be in manufacturing. But those are also the jobs that you can offshore. I mean, you can't offshore the installation jobs or the construction jobs.
Maintenance, stuff like that.
The maintenance, exactly. But you certainly can offshore, and you will offshore, the manufacturing unless you have the right policies. Another quick thing. You think of this, you know, moving to the clean energy economy. Well, what does that mean in practical terms? It sounds very esoteric to a lot of people. Well, obviously, it changes the source of your electricity. I mean, you still have it coming into your home, but instead of being generated from, say, you know, coal or what have you over time, it's generated through wind power, through solar power, what have you. But the thing that's worth noting here about solar and wind manufacturing is that, like, for instance, even though Germany isn't particularly sunny or particularly windy, it still makes a heck of a lot of this stuff because they want to have a manufacturing strategy to do it. Same goes for solar. I mean, Germany's not a sunny place, but they make
German beaches aren't known for their holiday getaways, are they?
They make a heck of a lot of solar equipment, and it's because they have domestic content requirements. It's because they have manufacturing tax credits. It's because they have skills and training programs that drive people into this. And just thinking about the old economy for a second, those steel mills, you know, and a lot of which are still in West Virginia, although not enough of them are operating. You know, there's 200 tons of steel that goes into every wind turbine. So that's a huge.
Somebody has to make it.
Somebody has to make it. Do we want to make it in China? Do we want to make it in the United States? There's a ton of steel that goes into every hybrid automobile that's made. So where do you want that steel made? Do you want to make it made in Japan? Do you want to make it in the United States? So we need a clean energy manufacturing strategy, but we need a broader manufacturing strategy.
But Scott, also when we talk about clean energy. And we talk about things like steel manufacturing, I think it's an important point to make, isn't it, that when American manufacturers manufacture steel, they do it in ways that leave a much lower footprint in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of the overall contribution to greenhouse gases and so forth. Isn't that correct?
Well, let me give you two examples. That's absolutely correct. American steel generates one-third of the carbon output per ton from a Chinese steel mill. So, you know, if you're getting your steel from China...
Is that because of production processes?
And that's just because of production processes. That has nothing to do with shipping or transportation. That only adds to it when you get when you get it on the bunker fuel and the barges going over the Pacific Oceans.
Sure.
But it's not because the Chinese don't have the technology. They do. They have the same types of scrubbers that we do. They just don't turn them on. Because they don't have to, because there is very little environmental regulation in China, and there's no way to hold China to account for this. So that's one example. Let me give you another example. There's a steel mill in Northwest Indiana, in East Chicago, that does combined heat transfer or cogeneration, it's called. So they capture the emissions, the heat emissions that are generated from the plant. And they sell it back on the grid, and it's enough power, Bob, to power 40,000 homes a year. So that's like a mid-sized city that you're just having a steel mill. Its heat output is generating that type of electricity, yet there's no capital to put this in steel mills in the United States. All it takes is a little government investment in something like this, and already, I mean, you've solved part of your problem right there without having to do a whole lot.
And one of the yesterday in the course of my conversation with Bob Borisage, knowing that I was going to be talking to you today, I talked with him a little bit in some stuff that's sort of a lead into this conversation, namely that he explained to me that the two words industrial policy are approaching anathema inside the Obama administration. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I can, and this is, we did a little bit of this of this public opinion research. So, you know, people really don't know what industrial policy is. They don't have a well-formed idea about what it is. I mean, and frankly, if you ask people, some people will say, well, I think it means the government running our factory. And that's the last thing I want the government to do is to run the factory in my town. Of course, that's not what it is at all. But the idea of industrial policy has been so denigrated by the right that it's become, you know, again, one of these buzzwords that they've tried to catch on to. Now, what it means, in all honesty, is having a manufacturing strategy. I mean, and you can parse the words, but here's the important thing to know. Every other country we compete with has such a strategy. They have, and whether you want to call it industrial policy, manufacturing strategy, they all have one. We don't. And so if we're playing one game and they're playing another game, we'll never be able to compete. I mean, it's just impossible.
By definition, they're going to be ahead of the curve because they've got forethought going into their processes.
Right, and it cuts across everything. It's the way they deliver health care and pay for it. It's the types of skills and training programs that they have for their workers. It's the type of trade policies they have. It's the value of the exchange rate that they set. It's their tax policy. It's the type of public investments that are made. It's the domestic content requirements they have for their procurement. And in all these counts, we have what Washington Post columnist Harold Meyerson once called an anti-industrial strategy. We do everything we can to drive manufacturing offshore and then bring the goods back to market. And somehow there's some quote-unquote consumer benefit out of this, even though people are making less and communities are a lot poorer than they used to be.
And that is that's an entirely separate segment of the conversation. The lack of the classic American manufacturing base does to individual communities. But where this want of a cohesive, cogent strategy leads us, then let me back up and ask it this way. Is the absence of that policy, the absence of that strategy, is that a function of some sort of misguided dedication to this concept of free trade that has led us so far down the primrose path?
Yes, is the short answer. There is and there's a precedent for this. When you think back to the views on the domino theory in foreign policy back in the 50s and the 60s, where you got to stop communism wherever it may start to rear its ugly head, because otherwise the dominoes will start to fall and eventually they'll get to our shores. You know, this justified our involvement in Vietnam. You know, everyone looks back and said, well, the domino theory is stupid. So it was fallacious.
Because it was never going to happen.
But it's fallacious, and it was, of course, it's kind of counterfactual. It's after the fact, but you know, there was a, you know, John Kennedy bought into this, you know, Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, this was not a partisan thing. It's the same sort of thing with free trade. I mean, it is it's an orthodoxy that both parties at the very top levels still ascribe to, and there's a lot of different reasons for it. Part of it is the teaching of classical economics without understanding how it really works. You talk to a guy like Paul Krugman now, who won a Nobel Prize in economics. He still believes in free trade, but he acknowledges its downsides, its considerable downsides, and the impact that it has on workers, and that it's not always a net benefit for a country like the United States.
A lot of those so-called free trade ideas come out of the Milton Friedman gang, for whom working people are of less import than raw materials.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. That part of it is this equation that you can bargain off American workers for other geopolitical aims. Like, we want China to help on North Korea, so we'll give them more market access. We'll ship more of our jobs there. That's the price we're willing to pay. You know, it was true actually since the end of World War II that we've been continuously doing this, and it's an enormous mistake. And we're the only country who does this.
Well, you mentioned earlier the German manufacturing, and they've got domestic content policies and policies that state the extent to which the clean energy, for instance, will be used within the domestic German market. Is that somehow deemed improper within our economic or capital structure?
Well, if you talk to the purists at the Cato Institute, they would say, oh, that's horrible. It's like Smoot-Hawley. You know, it's gonna wreck the world economy. The reality is everyone does it. We've been doing it for a long time. We've had our own domestic content requirements in this country, although they're very weak, but we've had them since the 1930s. One of the last presidents to expand them was, believe it or not, Ronald Reagan. And he did it because the one thing that he understood, even though he didn't understand a lot of things, is like, you gotta make defense stuff here. You know, and that's the one thing he felt very strongly about. And he had an industrial policy for our defense purchases, but
airplanes and tanks,
right? And even a little bit for semiconductors. But you got to beyond that, and it was a little tricky. But there's been this thread in American economic thought since the end of World War II that we're so big, we're so prosperous that we can pretty much give away access to our market. And the jobs that we lose in manufacturing will replace somewhere else. And the truth is, if you lose your job in manufacturing, what doesn't usually happen is you go off and get a master's degree and you start writing films. I mean, it just doesn't happen, even though that's the theory that they lead you to believe. What happens when people lose their manufacturing jobs, and 5 million people have lost their manufacturing jobs over the last decade, one-third of all manufacturing jobs, what happens to these people is that if they ever get employed again, and a lot of them don't, they just exit the workforce, but if they ever get employed again, it's usually in a service field or a healthcare field where they're making a fraction of the wages and benefits that they
once
were.
In many instances, less than a third of what they were making.
That's exactly right. And if they even get a manufacturing job, it usually takes them 15 years to make up the income that they lost in their last manufacturing position. And how is that good for America when you are basically impoverishing communities of workers and families who are essentially moving down the economic ladder rather than up? It's why there's a great feeling of anxiety out there, where people don't think that America has the strongest economy anymore. They don't think that the next generation is going to be better off than we are.
Because they don't see it happening.
They don't see the opportunity. I mean, they don't know where it's going to come from. I mean, what do you do with your son or daughter now? You say, well, you could work in massage therapy because you can't outsource that job. You can work in health care because there's going to be a lot of old people to care for. What else do you do? You can get a government job. It's one of the few things that's growing right now. But in the long run, what has to sustain our economy is the ability to produce things here. It what keeps our trade balance intact, because we have an enormous trade deficit right now. It's what generates wealth for communities. I mean, manufacturers are the largest taxpayers in the community wherever they are. I mean, they are the tax base, and when that factory leaves, that community becomes far poorer, and the chances are it'll never make up that
income. When we talk about communities being poorer, Scott, we're talking about things like contributions to the public commons, Little League, Midget League football, all the ways that we formerly, in the heyday of... And it's sad that we even mention that there was, as opposed to is, a heyday of the middle class. But in that heyday of the middle class, we defined our communities by what we did together. Not simply by the fact that we had a nice house and two cars in the driveway, but because there were communities that we had a sense of community built on what we could do for ourselves together, whether it's making sure the trash gets picked up three times a week instead of one, or whether it's a matter of being able to keep the ball fields open because we've got the tax base to pay city workers who do that kind of thing. And this all goes back, and I mean, I know it personally because My father worked in manufacturing. And when that goes away, there's so much more that closes besides the mill or the stamping plant or something like that. It takes the rest of America with it, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, it certainly breaks down the social fabric that we have. And it is a, there have been many studies about this, the health effects, the effects on divorce rates, crime, drug crime in particular. At the same time, the demand on public services goes up, the revenue goes down, so you have a hard time paying for the firefighting and the policemen and the roads and the schools. And so it heralds the disintegration of a community. Now, you can use some, there's some great, and I don't mean great in a positive sense, but there are some startling examples of both like mid-sized towns that lost their steel mill and what's happened to them. You know, they had a population exodus out of town. The crime rate went up. The unemployment rate went up. Young people fled as fast as they could, and it completely changed the nature of that town. When you look at America's urban centers that used to manufacture, places like Detroit or Cleveland, and this is unbelievable, but it's true. You have not seen urban centers empty out at this rate since the bubonic plague in Europe.
There was a story a couple of years ago about Detroit in which the author compared certain portions of the city of Detroit with the Mayan cities being reclaimed by the jungle, where the grass was growing back up through the asphalt and the countryside was coming back in around the city. And this is what you're talking about.
That's exactly right. And it's the shame of it is, I mean, and if this was a relic of the past, if manufacturing was a relic of the past, then you're like, okay, I accept this. We're going to move on. We're going to build something better. But that's not what happened.
You just used the word build, and if you're going to build, you have to manufacture.
That's not what's happening. And you know, will manufacturing look the same in 10 years as it does today? No. I mean, there's constantly improvements that are being made, just like in a steel mill today. It's not like a steel mill was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I mean, these are modern facilities inside. They're highly efficient. They can compete on a level playing field. But what we've managed to screw up in this country are a couple of things. We've screwed up trade policy. We give away access to our markets, and we don't get market access in return. That means we're losing jobs. Number two, our tax code is oriented towards helping guys on Wall Street, or helping people who are exploring fossil fuels, and it really screws people who are trying to produce things in this country. And then the third thing is our educational system is so biased against the vocational trades these days. I mean, it's hard to find high schools that have like robust vocational education programs out there, and then community colleges to translate that. So we're going to have the paradox of having an aging manufacturing workforce that's going to exit, even though manufacturing is still shrinking in this country a little bit. And we're going to have a hard time filling those jobs because our young people don't know that there can be careers in them.
And it
becomes a death spiral.
And you actually lose, because when you lose that 30-year veteran on the production floor and there's no kid behind him, you actually lose more when the guy retires or woman. You lose an entire culture of technology, don't you? I go to a lot of meetings and so forth. You know, I will see dedicated people who are 60 years old, nearing retirement, or my age, our age, and you very seldom see the 22-year-old.
That's right.
That's exactly right. And when you're down to reinventing the wheel like that, Scott, you're trying to get put a manufacturing base back together, you're doing it with one foot in a bucket, aren't
mm-hmm.
you?
You bet. And the shame of it is, Bob, is that young people, if they knew there were opportunities, would love a career like this, because people naturally like to tinker. They like to create something. They like to see the end result of their product. And there's really no other profession that gives you that sense of satisfaction, unless you're some sort of an artist, that you've that you've created something.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a much more satisfying, and this is what people don't understand. They're like, oh, those poor slobs who work in manufacturing. Boy, woe are them. But then they actually talk to folks who are in manufacturing who take great pride in their
who
work.
Who love their jobs.
And the fact that they're producing a quality product, and they're delivering value for their company, they're making something that customers want, and they're able to support their families and make them secure. And that's something that Americans don't appreciate nearly enough right now.
Because we've forgotten it because it went away, and it was allowed to go away. I know exactly what you're talking about because a couple of times as a little boy, my dad took me onto the furnace floor. Back in the day, OSHA would have had a fit, you know, 10-year-old running around a silicon furnace. But to look, the thing that about my dad with that was that, and he's still a presence in my life. I mean, it's such a profound impact he made. But he would laughingly say, "Goody, I get to go to work today." He loved, he had a relationship with that furnace that was unbelievable. That gave him a sense of fulfillment and gave him a sense of accomplishment, and he said, "There's nothing on earth I would rather be doing, unless maybe it was his other dream was to be a college football coach." But he was happy on that furnace. All the guys he worked with loved their work, and it wasn't just because they had decent pay and good pension benefits and health care, but those are all things that come with it as well, because the collapse of our health care system can be attributed to the decline of our industrial base as well, because insofar as, you know, when I was a kid, got sick, go to the doctor, the insurance took care of it, it was all 100%, and then comes the rise of the HMO, and all because health care costs, by virtue of a shrinking pool, became more difficult to put out. So there are so many facets to this. You and I are sitting here having this conversation, Scott, and it seems like a no-brainer. This is I don't say the task is easy, mm-hmm. but simply understanding the necessity is easy.
Why isn't it for an
administration that you would think would benefit monumentally by it?
Well, it's overcoming this economic philosophy that is really embedded in the ruling class. That's one of the biggest challenges. Now, the research that Mark Melman for us did, that when you look at the specifics, like having a manufacturing strategy and changing our trade policy and our policy on exchange rates and skills and training and giving incentives to manufacture, there is overwhelming across-the-board support for this, even among Tea Party supporters. In fact,
wow.
Support among Tea Party supporters is at least as strong as support among union members for a lot of this. There is a lot of overlap. There's a lot of support for this. But it's overcoming, again, this kind of domino theory prevailing wisdom that folks have about free trade and about how we can transition from manufacturing to services. I mean, we have tried that, and we see where it got us.
Yeah,
which is you know, long-term unemployment is, you know, and people out of the job market is still 16%. We are a debtor nation. We owe $2 trillion to China. We have a $700 billion trade deficit a year. We've lost 50,000 factories over the last decade. We've lost a third of our manufacturing workforce. And young people have no opportunities.
And even from a national security standpoint, Scott, we could not defend ourselves if we had to call on our nation to do what this nation did in terms of retooling and reengineering at the start of the Second World War. We had an idled industrial base, but it was present, and it could be retooled in a short, relatively short period of time. We were producing, you know, massive amounts of war materials. I'm a peacenik. I don't ever want that to happen again. But it is a sobering thing to realize that where that was an idled system, well, the system we have now is non-existent in large part. It wouldn't be a matter of retooling and gearing back up. It would be reinvent the wheel and go from bare ground up.
Yeah, 13 of the key industries that finance or that make up our defense industrial base, including machine tools and printed circuit boards and things like that that go into the armaments, they've virtually disappeared from this country. And there are now, belatedly, alarm bells going off about this. Because do we want to be dependent on China for our machine tools, for our printed circuit boards, for the other stuff that goes into our sophisticated military
equipment?
Because,
in essence, they have the power of yay or nay over whether or not we even defend ourselves.
Well, you bet. So that's the real problem. And that's a wake-up call on the conservative side. But what gives me a little hope, Bob, is that I think people have looked at the alternatives out there, and they've said, yeah, we need to invest in manufacturing. There was a Gallup poll that was done about 2 months ago where Gallup just asked an open-ended question of the 1,000 people who took the poll. And they said, what's the best way to create jobs in the U.S. and to get the economy moving again? The number one response that people volunteered was keep manufacturing jobs in the United States. Even though...
So they weren't even prompted for it.
They weren't even prompted for it. It was better than tax cuts. It was better than virtually everything else. There were only 8 answers that scored above 4% because there was like a disparate thing. But keep manufacturing jobs was the highest scoring one. And Buy America was another one that registered. And you combine those two together, and that's without a lot of education. I mean, it's instinctual. People know this. There's voter demand for this. Our poll shows it. We just need Washington to have the courage to do this. We're not talking about a Wall Street bailout. We're talking about a level playing field. We're talking about strategic investments that will make a difference in our future so that we'll be building car batteries, that power vehicles in the U.S. rather than in Korea or Taiwan or Japan.
We're talking about getting our foot out of the bucket. Like I said earlier, going uphill with one foot in the bucket. Just getting it. All we want to do is get our foot out of the bucket. And walk like everybody else.
You bet.
Let me ask then. I get your emails and it's magnificent work that the Alliance is doing, Scott. You're putting out a lot of data. You're putting out a lot of stuff that that people can really get their heads around in terms of what is needed. How do we go forward? How does someone listening to this program engage themselves in this issue?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. And we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan labor management partnership, which makes us pretty unique in Washington.
Indeed,
because
it does.
People are like, well, there's actually companies and a union who want to do this. Wow, they're working together. That's pretty amazing to people. But it's true. We have an activist corps that is free to join, and there's no obligation whatever. You can sign up at AmericanManufacturing.org. We also have information about manufacturing in every state in the country, including how many jobs every congressional district has lost to China because of our
flawed trade
policies.
So you've got it broken down that far.
We do. You bet we do. We currently have a campaign underway to try to persuade the administration and the Congress to get tough with China on its currency policy, which is costing a lot of jobs. And that's something that we can control because we can condition our market access on China's behavior. And so far, we've been unwilling to do that. Reagan was willing to do that, and Nixon was willing to do that. And I hate using these Republican examples,
but I understand.
But they were forced by Democratic Congresses to make the right decisions on this stuff. And Obama can certainly do this. I mean, he ought to get it. I mean, he did community organizing in the shadows of a steel mill, so he knows what it's all about.
I guess that's one of the things that scares me a little bit about President Obama from time to time, is while you're absolutely correct, Scott, that he did that, he also comes out of a teaching position at the University of Chicago, and there is nothing good that there's nothing good that happens for American working people that takes place inside the halls of the University of Chicago.
Yeah, you're right. Although I would say that in terms of realpolitik, you know, John Mearsheimer, who's very controversial in their foreign policy field, would agree with us on manufacturing and would shame their economics department for exposing America to so much risk. So, but you're absolutely right. But I'm hoping his organizing instincts can overcome his kind of Ivy League and kind of erudite economic and legal education. I think it can, because he spent a lot of time in the industrial Midwest. We had him in Pittsburgh for a candidates forum, and he said all the right things, but we got to get him to do the right things.
And that's that whole, I like what you're doing, I believe in what you're doing, now make me do it sort of thing.
That's
and that's
exactly
the, and
right.
That's the weight that you build through your activist yeah. corps.
And we do town hall meetings. People can get engaged with that. We actually have some terrific activists in West Virginia. Lou Delator, who's up in the Panhandle, and mm-hmm. we also have Meredith Mariner, who does some work for us. And they, you know, they try to get around the state, and they talk to everyone from chambers of commerce to local schools to retirees about the need for a strong manufacturing base and how it's important. But it costs nothing to join. We welcome any activist from any background who all they want to have to do is have a core belief that they want to make stuff in this country.
Hear, hear. Scott Paul, thank you very much. I absolutely enjoy our conversations every time we have them, and I wish you the best of luck. And anything we can do to help, please let us know and know that we're out there and trying to get the message out with
well,
you.
Well, Bob, keep up the good work yourself. Really appreciate being on.
Thank you very kindly, Scott. Bye now. Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, indeed a unique organization, a partnership between manufacturing and labor in this country, a model that could well we could do well to see more of. Go there, go to the website, and if you're so inclined, sign up so that you can keep receiving the information that is generated by the Alliance, because it's really eye-opening stuff. It's easy to forget the role that manufacturing played in the rise of this nation and where it's going to go and where this country is going to go next as we try to envision among other things, a clean energy future. So, you know, go and inform yourself. Being informed is the first part of change, really. We are about to go to our next guest, John Gensler. Come right ahead. Hi, John. I'm Bob. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
This has been a magnificent conference, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
A lot of great ideas out there. John Gensler is with us, and tell us, if you please, John, just give folks the thumbnail of your activism, what you do.
All right. Well, I'm a native of Huntington, West Virginia, former Army officer and Iraq veteran. I've been involved with a group called Operation Free over the last year, which is a group now of about 400 recent veterans and other national security experts who have been traveling around the country talking about the very severe national security threats that are posed to America by our current energy policy and climate change. And we've been hitting VFW halls across the country, bus tour, and hitting the halls of Congress here on the Hill, trying to explain and demonstrate to our members of Congress that they need to act.
Well, I'm really tickled that they got you on the schedule here, because, of course, while the Horn is a global operation, we're headquartered in mm-hmm. West Virginia, and issues such as you're describing are of critical importance. Especially in a place like Central Appalachia,
absolutely,
where our failure to address climate change is rapidly leading to the elimination of Appalachian culture as we know it, and I'm sure you're well aware of it.
I am very, very well aware of it.
When you speak to veterans groups, do they get it? Do folks understand the drastic? Well, not drastic, but the dangers that this nation faces that arise from what can happen with climate change and what it can do to our ability to be secure going forward?
I think that they're beginning to. Certainly we've had a lot of success over the last year in talking to veterans around the country and with people here in Congress. Climate change and our energy policy really affect us in a couple of different ways, which were brought home to me. I buried a fellow West Virginian, another captain in the Army, just a few miles from here in Arlington Cemetery in December 2007, killed by an IED that struck his Humvee. That IED was likely financed by Iran. And we as Americans are sending $100 million every day to Iran through our current energy policy, through the demand for oil that we have in this country is financing both sides of the war on terror and causing American soldiers, Marines, airmen, to give up their life unnecessarily.
It is almost, John, as though. It is, in my opinion, a very cynical use of one of the most precious, if not the most precious, resource that this country has, and that is the people who are willing to stand in the breach. And when you're standing in the breach and you realize that you're in a crossfire that is self-created, that's got to create somewhat of an existential crisis, doesn't it?
It does. Because it's not only the national security threats that are posed just by our demand for oil in this country, but it's also climate change itself, which the data is in. There's a large consensus that it is happening, and that we are causing it, at least some portion of it. Now, the Department of Defense and the CIA both recognize this. They both have centers on climate change and how it's going to impact our national security. They're looking at this as something that's going to destabilize already unstable regions of the world.
How is it that the military can recognize issues related to climate change as having a direct impact on American national security, and yet out here in the civilian world, or whatever we care to call it, it is such an ongoing struggle just to get people to acknowledge it. I don't know if you saw it or not, but that study that came out, or polling data that came out a week or two ago, that said that right now people are trending away from believing that climate change is even real. Obviously, that's a function of the right-wing echo machine and so forth, but you've got a unique perspective. How do you awaken people to the fact that this is not only an existential threat or a domestic threat, that it is a real national security problem?
Well, I think it was Upton Sinclair who said that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends upon him not understanding it.
One of my favorite quotes.
In the military, our lives depend on us understanding all of the threats that are out there and in preparing ourselves to deal with them adequately. So it's a no-brainer. If something appears that it's going to cause future deployments, create combat zones that we're going to have to operate in the future, that's something that the U.S. military needs to take actions to prevent and to deal with.
And spends time, effort, and resources contemplating how that shakes out.
Absolutely. But not only, it's a threat to us, but this is also a tremendous opportunity. With the race to a low-carbon economy going on in the world right now, whoever wins that race, whoever gets there first and develops the clean tech companies, they're going to dominate the global economy for this century. I personally would like to see that.
Be us.
I'd like to see that in central Appalachia.
What is the number? And it was something absolutely that just make your eyes roll back in your head. The per gallon cost of fuel for a vehicle being run by the military in Afghanistan, upwards of $400 a gallon or some such.
Yeah, when you include all the support that it takes to get that gallon of gas to the vehicle at an outpost in Afghanistan, it is a massive amount. I don't know the exact number, but you're right.
Napoleon said an army marches on its stomach. It would appear that in the 21st century, the army's stomach is consuming fossil fuels.
It is, but it's also doing a lot. It recognizes the threat that poses, and I would say that the military is actually leading the way. I believe it was the Air Force who just tested what they're calling the Green Hornet. It's a standard fighter jet run completely on biofuels. Not a petroleum fuel drop in it.
And thank God, not liquid coal.
Because
I know the Air Force was, there was a steady drumbeat some years back, led sadly by Senator Rockefeller and Congressman Rahal, to get the Air Force to run on liquid coal, which would have been just another horror for our neck of the woods.
Well, it would have been. The sole reliance on coal as a resource has been devastating to the economies of Central Appalachia. The 30 years of decline have been locked in with 30 years of the development of other coal resources elsewhere in the world, the prevention of investment in our people. I mean, you can go down paths with the limited resources that we have. You can exploit the natural resources and tear down our mountains and the heritage, or you can invest in the people and foster the development of new technologies, of new ways of doing business. And this is a choice that we have to make. What do we want to do? Do we want to keep our mountains and keep our people, or do we want to rip our mountains down for short-term gain and contribute to, you know, threats to our economy, to national security, and while destroying our environment?
And coming from Huntington as you do, I trust you're passingly familiar with the coal fields then.
Oh, I am.
And so you know that wherever something like mountaintop removal takes place, and all that prosperity and all that wealth is running on a train out of Mingo County or out of Logan County, at the same time you find out that the most grievous, bone-crushing poverty is right there where all that wealth is leaving.
Yeah. I don't know how you explain that the West Virginia 3rd Congressional District, one of the poorest, if not the poorest district, it's one of the poorest districts in the country, and yet we have amazing natural resources. We have hardworking people who've been there for centuries, who care about the land, who care about where they're from. And yeah, it's you know, the coal severance tax that we get doesn't begin.
It's laughable.
It's laughable. It doesn't begin to make up for what we're losing.
Well, you know, it's funny. I drove here from West Virginia, John, and of course I had to tank up in West Virginia, and I paid approaching $2.80 a gallon for a gallon of gasoline. I'm sure maybe somebody in San Francisco says, well, you're getting off easy. That's San Francisco. Just because I changed from West Virginia to Virginia, the gas price went down 30 cents. And that's because of West Virginia, you know, Central Appalachian taxation policy on fossil fuels. And that extra 30 cents is there because we're going to leech it out of working people. We're going to do regressive taxation that literally sucks money out of working people and poor folks' wallets because we don't have the will to deal with the coal industry that has never and is not now paid its fair share in terms of the upkeep of the state. A place like West Virginia should be the wealthiest state in the union. But it isn't because it's been because of the absence of any sort of, well, I don't, you know, I know, West Virginia is West Virginia's state government is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry. Can we just say that?
You just did.
Yeah, I think so. So I'm sure you've driven by the John Amos plant in the Kanawha Valley.
More times than my sister used to live just down the road from it.
And so. You know, I go up US 60 to my home, and there's coal-fired power plant. And it's killing us. And it's not just killing us hillbillies. That statistic that's out there that blew me away, because it wasn't some wild-eyed environmentalist that came up with this. It was the American Lung Association.
Mm-hmm.
Who you know, usually when you read the American Lung Association, they're concerning themselves with, you know, getting me to stop smoking. But in this case, they put out a statistic, 24,000 Americans. Can you imagine that? Half of the losses of Vietnam die every year because we insist on burning coal for electricity in this country.
Yeah.
That's not 24,000 people in Virginia, West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, or Tennessee. That's 24,000 people all around this country. Drop dead because we still insist on burning coal for electricity.
It's amazing, isn't it?
How can we call ourselves enlightened people or the 21st century people?
I mean, this is what powered the 19th century.
Exactly. This was great for the Industrial Revolution. It's been over for a while.
Been over.
We need a second Industrial Revolution. So, with Operation Free, are you guys behind? Do you get strongly behind issues of trying to create the green energy infrastructure, trying to create the green energy grid, and so forth?
Absolutely. We consider our mission to be to secure America with clean energy, as quickly as we can, and that's going to require, you know, significant investment, you know, in developing a smart grid to transport electricity around the country where it needs to be, in developing the technologies to create that electricity from renewable sources. and to figure out a way to burn coal a little bit more cleanly while we enact this transition. It's probably going to require an enhancement of nuclear power, which I know a lot of people have issues with.
It gives me the creeps, but...
I can understand that. I mean, it has...
Nobody wants it in their backyard.
Nobody does. But the challenges that we're facing, I think we really require...
Well, there are transition fuels out there, you know, things like natural gas. I don't have a problem talking about that, because there's no... There's no clean energy sparkle pony out there.
It's not. It's not there.
That's going to make it all happen tomorrow. I think in the course of our discussion, I think what we're trying to get people to acknowledge, and frankly, where we come from in West Virginia, it's nigh unto impossible with a lot of people. You have to get them to confront their own future. And that is the fact that whether you are a friend of coal or a friend of the mountains, it really doesn't matter, because the coal is going to run out sooner rather than later. 20 years, Nick Joe Ray Hall said. 20 years.
I've seen a number of studies that said, 20 years is very likely. And what's going to happen when the coal operators are gone, when they pack up their equipment and go somewhere else?
Well, they're going to do what they've always done and leave us high and dry.
Exactly.
You know, hey, look at the poor hillbillies.
Yeah, I look at my nieces and nephews back in Huntington and Charleston. Like, I look at the friends I grew up with who still live there. I'm 30. You know, in 20 years, the folks I grew up with are going to be 50. What are they going to do when a large portion of our economy is gone?
Why can't, John?
We got to diversify.
Absolutely, we do. And why can't we get that message through to a Joe Manchin, to a Nick Ray Hall? As a member of an activist group that opposes mountaintop removal,
I am a big fan.
I can't even. Senator Rockefeller won't even meet with us anymore. He just says, I will not talk about the end of coal. I will not talk about that dark day. I want nothing to do with it. And it's fingers in the ears and la, 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 la. But the fact of the matter is, that's not a strategy. That's not a plan. That's not a project. That is denial.
That's sticking your head down into the coal mine. And
well said. Well said. How do we get through to these people? I mean, it seems frustrating to try. I live in a state senatorial mm-hmm. district where I had a good senator, a good man by the name of Randy White. He just got beaten in the primary by a man who sent out flyers that showed lumps of coal in a Christmas stocking, saying, "I think coal is nice, not naughty." This guy won the primary, so if he wins the general election, well, that's one less state senator that I've got that I can talk to. That goes back to the previous question about people not even wanting to think about confronting their future. Yelling doesn't work.
Yelling,
what do you do?
Yelling doesn't work. You remind people of the costs. You know, yeah. I could talk about my fellow West Virginian, his Captain Ben Tiffner,
good.
Who was
Say
killed.
His name.
Yeah, and. He was from northern West Virginia. I went to West Point with him, and he's dead now. You know, he was a smart future leader of our state, and he's no longer with us because, you know, he was killed by a bomb that was financed by our gross addiction to oil.
Because in 1977, Jimmy Carter said, we've got to start getting away from this. We'd already had a couple of oil crises. Gerald Ford said we got to start getting away from this. Richard Nixon said we got to start getting away from this. But Ronald Reagan takes office. The solar panels come off the White House. And then the last eight years where Katie barred the door for the oil industry, as we now know, looking at what deregulation did that's the whole thing, John. That's not oil washing up on the white sand beaches of the Gulf. That's deregulation washing up. That's unregulated predatory conservatism washing up on those beaches. And, I mean, that's just me. That's how I am. Because we're paying a price in blood. You know, it's
we are.
It hurts to pay it out of your wallet. It sucks to pay it out of your human dignity, and we pay that too. You know, this was once a nation that strode greatly across the planet. Now, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said, "Walk softly and carry a big stick." We walked softly and we threw the stick away, because you know we dare not, and so it become, and then you know we come to the questions of blood, and they are ultimately questions of how much of our life's blood are we willing to have leach away into the sand before we realize that there is a better way. You know, I heard Van Jones say a couple of years ago that as we contemplate green energy and clean energy, that we also have to contemplate it philosophically in terms of social justice as well. And this was the takeaway line that just tattooed itself on the in the wrinkles of my brain. Mm-hmm. He said, otherwise, in 50 years, we're going to be fighting wars over the lithium that powers the batteries that run our tanks.
Over lithium, over the rare earth metals that go into the magnets inside wind turbines. I mean, there are a lot of issues.
Yes.
But we can figure them out because right. We're at the cusp of those technologies. You know, we're not locked in to a path yet. We want to be the ones to dictate what the path is so that it's best for all Americans, which is ultimately best for the rest of the world.
Exactly. Because, you know, we're 4% of the world's population. We use 25% of its resources. We're better than that. So what's Operation Free doing right now?
Well, we just had a big rally up in Boston a few weeks ago up in Faneuil Hall. We're pushing for the passage of the American Power Act, which was sponsored by Senators Kerry and Lieberman, co-wrote by Senator Graham, although he's not
backed away,
he's backed away from sponsoring, although he's not, I mean, he's not shy to say, yeah, he helped craft
he's not
it.
He's not actively opposing
he's
it.
Certainly not actively opposing it yet. But this is in today's political climate, a unique bipartisan effort to move America forward. And it's certainly not perfect, but it goes a long way towards telling the market there's a price on carbon, towards funding development of new technologies that are going to lead the way in this century. And I think it's a pretty good bill.
And this is for all intents and purposes, this is the Senate counterpart to Waxman-Markey in
yeah.
the House. We're fast approaching mid-June. Congress moves glacially when it moves at all.
Mm-hmm.
This Congress will end at the end of December. What has to happen, in your opinion, to make some sort of climate change bill happen in this country? When you're up against the Coburns and so forth.
People need to call their senators. I know there are people out there who would support action, but most Americans, you know, they don't get involved politically.
Well, you know, you and I as West Virginians, we have, like everybody else, we have two senators. In his late age, Senator Byrd is showing stunning leadership.
I agree.
In terms of once again, getting it.
He sees the future.
How do you? But when you're contemplating things like a crippled Senate that can barely tie it, well, it can't decide where it wants to go to lunch without someone filibustering it, generally from the Republican side. How do you get this bill passed when you know more likely than not that you won't? It's not going to just be the usual GOP suspects who are trying to kill the bill. That you will have active hostility coming from people like Jay Rockefeller.
You know, this is, as much as it is an environmental bill and an economic bill, this is a national security bill, which is what we believe, the vets of Operation Free. This is vital to our national security. This is vital to ensuring American interests abroad, which I think every American can agree need to be protected. This is vital to that. So, going beyond the environmental and the economic arguments and really stressing, this is about the lives of American soldiers. This is about the sons and daughters of America on the front lines defending our freedom and liberty is a strong story. And I wager it would be hard for many senators to vote no on a bill when America sees this as vital to our national security.
I hope you're right, John.
I hope I'm right, too.
I'm a little bit not skeptical, but scared because I've seen the behavior of the right wing, especially in the Senate, and when they are willing to hold up the entire appropriations bill for the entire military over a single issue, as they have shown themselves willing to do in the recent past, that gives me pause because it makes me wonder if all of I'm unabashedly liberal. I just am. But it makes me wonder if all of that flag waving that the right wing has done has been a much more cynical exercise than even I ever contemplated it might be.
I certainly hope that it's not. If it is, then hopefully the American people will learn. You know, this is our government. These decisions are ultimately our responsibility. And we need to put the people in office who are going to do right by us. And if we learn from the cynicism of the Congress, that would be a good thing. It's not too late. Next year would be, if we can get a bill passed sometime soon, this is a long-term problem. This isn't something that can be solved right now.
And it will not be solved by one bill.
Absolutely not. This is a series of steps that we need. This is rebuilding our economy for the future. This is a massive undertaking, but the kind of undertaking that Americans have proven very successful at in the past, unique amongst nations.
It is. Well, I view climate change from the standpoint of my parents were Depression children, and my father was a Second World War veteran. And I view what we face with global climate change on the same level from a strategic standpoint, if not tactical, but from a strategic standpoint, as what this nation faced in dealing with the Axis powers in the Second World War.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an existential threat like that. But it's also, you know, I think of it more as something akin to the Marshall Plan.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Where we had a massive investment that created a world of secure nations and allies around
us. That could stop doing world wars.
Exactly.
And it was that, because, again, it was that kind of insecurity that led to the stupidity of August 1914 and led to the desperation that allowed the rise of fascism in Italy and National Socialism in Germany, and allowed the fascists to take over in Imperial Japan. I think we failed to draw the parallels of history at our peril.
Absolutely.
John Gensler, thank you very much.
That was absolutely a pleasure.
I'm so glad we had a chance to talk. And,
me too, Bob.
Anything that I can do to help, please let us know at the horn at operationfree.net.
That is correct.
Is it interactive? Can folks get involved? If they've got a son, a daughter who's back from Iraq or Afghanistan, who has seen for themselves, as you have seen for yourself, do you invite that participation?
Yes, we do. We're always looking to grow the people that we have involved with us. The more voices that we have, the more real voices and real stories we have, the more powerful the message becomes. So go to the website. If you're a veteran and you care about these types of issues, go to our website. You can find out who you need to contact locally to get involved. We welcome your participation.
And that's not just veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan.
No, this is veterans from all wars. We have guys from a couple of Vietnam vets. We've got guys from the first Gulf War involved.
Right.
If you've served in a uniform, we want you. Keep serving. This is a new mission.
Exactly. Well, it's a noble undertaking, John. Thank you very much,
Thank
sir.
You.
And best of luck. Take care. You're doing God's work.
Yeah, I feel like it. Thank you.
Bye now. John Gensler from Operation Free. OperationFree.net is the website. Involve yourself. This is a unique perspective that they bring to the issue of climate change. And it not only unique, but legitimate in a way that maybe some of the rest of us who did not serve in the military can comprehend what climate change is doing and will do to this country. We are at the top of the hour, and in fact, things are moving along swimmingly. I know you are all going to be. There's a lot of you going to be tickled pink by my next guest. Cenk Uygur is here. The young Turk among the young Turks. Cenk, how long have you been at it?
We started the original radio show in February 14th, 2002. So it's now been over 8 years. And online we started in December of 2005. So we've been doing online television live daily since 5 years now.
That and the TV angle is something that I find really fascinating, because you know, I've got a face made for radio, and we're doing our little online video experiment right now, and I find it just horrifying. Hey, y'all, Chink says hey. First of all, let's go back to the genesis of the Young Turks, because you started doing what you're doing at almost the very same time that I started what I was doing, and I would hazard a guess that there was a similar undercurrent or a similar motivation for it in watching the excesses and the unfolding budding horrors of the Bush administration. Is that correct?
Yes. Now, we had started the radio show independent of Bush because I just wanted to get back to doing talk shows, because I was a TV writer and commentator for a while, but I wanted to have my own show and go back to doing that. It's just, as we started, that's when we began to be horrified by what Bush was doing. And we said, wow, that's terrible. You have to remember, this is something that's interesting. At the time, I was still a Republican. And then as Bush became crazier and crazier, if that's possible, and dumber, if that's possible, that's when I said, okay, no mas. And we actually became a progressive radio show. And partly because nobody else was doing it. Jesus, I'm like, when is somebody going to speak up for this position? And partly because Bush was so damn bad, it was impossible, I thought, for sane people not to speak out.
And you did begin that process. Were you always based in L.A.?
This version of the show, The Young Turks, yes, always in L.A.
Okay. Broadcast wasn't your entire history, was it? I mean, you came from a different place.
Right. I was a lawyer, very briefly. I didn't really like it, but then
rather
I...
Rather a soul-consuming experience, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, if your soul can survive it, yeah.
Okay.
Right, exactly. So, and I did that briefly in Washington, D.C. here. I was a corporate lawyer for about 7 months, and then I started to get into media, and I did radio first, and then eventually... television, and then back to radio, and then back to online video, in a sense.
What has been your experience with the online experience? Because, or your sense of the potential of it? Because the fact of the matter is, you know, we spend a lot of time on the horn talking about the for-profit media. We mm-hmm. don't call them the mainstream media. No, they're the for-profit media. Anything, you know, it's like Larry Darrell and Daryl. Anything for a buck, if you remember the old Newhart show. That's what the for-profit media does. When you get out into the internet, do you feel like you're a freer individual in terms of what you can do, how you can manifest your message, how you can carry it across?
Well, the most important part of that is that there are no gatekeepers anymore, which is enormously important, because if you go on traditional television or radio or anywhere else, there's going to be a program director or an executive producer who's going to say, don't say that, don't say that. Oh, my God, I can't believe you offended a politician. Yeah, we're supposed to find out what they're up to, right?
Inflicting the comfortable, that thing.
Right. So in the new media, you don't have that. You're your own boss, and for better or for worse, and you make it what you want it to be. And luckily, the audience has responded to what we do, and they said, yeah, give me more of that. Give me a little bit more truth. I like that. And you're right. The politicians don't work for us. They work for the people who pay them, the lobbyists. And so the great thing about new media is if you tell the truth, more people will come.
Without a doubt. And when you talk about more people will come, how many folks are you getting to these days?
We get 13 million views a month on YouTube.
Wow.
We're at nearly 250 million views for our YouTube channel right now.
So that's post-production, basically. Mm-hmm. Do you work live as well?
Yes, we work live. We're on theyoungturks.com. You can always see the show live there, and that has not only a significant audience, but that's our core, our members that podcast our show. They're our boss,
right?
Because they pay our bills, so we serve our audience. We're set up, we're structured to serve our audience rather than to serve corporate interests or whatever it might be.
I hope you'll forgive me for eavesdropping, but I heard you doing an interview up here at the top of the stairwell a little bit ago, and I heard a question put to you about your views of the commercialization of internet broadcasting. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because what I heard you say was absolutely fascinating about your ability to, on the one hand, sure, it's nice if we can help people move some product, but by the same token, on the other hand, we can tell people to take a hike.
Absolutely. First of all, I encourage everybody to eavesdrop on me. Okay. We do a three-hour show, so by all means, eavesdrop. Yes, as far as the commercialization, here's our philosophy on it. Look, we're going to do this show, and if you like this show and you want to support it as someone who's listening and become a member and pay your $10 a month and get it at convenience, no ads, et cetera, great. We love you for that, and that's a very important model. Now, if you're a sponsor and you say, hey, I like the show as it is, and I'd like to reach your audience, great. We love that. We're not anti-corporate in that sense. We're not anti-sponsor for sure. We just don't want the corporations controlling our politics and our politicians.
It's
and we
not
don't
that
want
you're
to...
anti-anything. You're pro-message.
Right. And I always tell people I'm a huge capitalist. I've never said anything otherwise. I believe in capitalism. The problem is corporatism destroys capitalism.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, it's not at all. And Adam Smith is the first guy who warned us about it. He said as soon as you create these entities, they're going to want to kill competition. It makes sense.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, Cenk, because one of the things that we've sort of had by virtue of the way we work on the horn, there's a whole lot of interchange back and forth, and it's like one big brainstorming session for 3 hours a night. And one of the things that has come out first of all, it's a liberal audience, and you understand the same. I'm sure you've got some conservatives of you.
Right.
I've got lurkers too. But yeah.
Right.
One of the things, we process information differently than the right wing does. Mm-hmm. They do marching orders. We do cat herding.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I did that has been processing out is that for all of the right wing's talk about their adoration and in fact, slavish worship of so-called Adam Smith's capitalism, they're not doing that. This isn't even Adam Smith anymore, and it hasn't been for a long, long time. The phrase that we came up with it was anarcho-randianism, because when you get to the end of the day, what they're not talking about Adam Smith anymore. They're talking about the hateful philosophy that is born out in that miserable, miserable piece of garbage, Atlas Shrugged. Can you see some of that as well?
See, what they're not grasping, and for a good reason, is that capitalism needs rules. It needs refs. And Adam Smith laid it out. Just read his book, okay? The Wealth of Nations, among others. The whole thing needs structure, right? It's not anarchy. It's not supposed to be anarchy. And if you wanna be a real capitalist and give consumers choice and have the invisible hand work, etc., you need refs. You can't play a basketball game or a football game without refs. Otherwise, everybody kills each other, right? Michael Jordan would have lasted 13 minutes before somebody tomahawked him. You need refs, okay? We want capitalism to work. We want free markets, right? And now, why has the right wing been misled in another direction? Because the corporations took over the right wing. They set up the think tanks. They set up the foundations, the fake grassroots groups, etc., to capture the right wing in this country and lead them in a corporatist direction rather than a capitalist direction. It's done on purpose. It's just the only people who haven't woken up to it is the actual right wing voters. We're trying to educate them on that. And I'm a long-term optimist. I think we can get there. We just have to keep plugging away. Let them know we're actually on their side in a lot of ways.
Well, working folks, the eternal question is, and it goes back to, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? Why do people vote against their wallets? Maybe it's tough to vote against your religion. Maybe it's difficult to vote against your social feelings. But my God, if you vote against your wallet, there's not going to be anything left of you to carry the banner for those other issues, right?
Absolutely. But look, they capture every issue. I mean, Christianity is all about giving to the poor, helping one another, community, love your neighbor. Okay, now what has the Republican Party done? Hate your neighbor, make sure he doesn't grab any of your money, keep all the money for yourself.
And he might be a terrorist.
Right, cut taxes and watch out for him. And if he slaps you, don't you dare turn the other cheek, hit him over the head with a nuke, right? Now, what part of that is Christian? None of it. All they did was they just said, we're the Christian Party, that's it. Well, why do we accept that? You shouldn't accept that. You should fight that guns blazing. So they're not Christian at all. I don't accept anything they say. Everything is propaganda so they can make more money.
Well, and that's what, again, we're back to Larry Darrell and Darrell and anything for a buck again.
Right.
Well, Cenk, where do you see you're out there with probably a better thumb on the pulse beat than I am. Is this model or this idea of leveraging the Internet as a means of getting past the gatekeeping and the fact that the right wing owns the public airwaves, is it working? Is it taking hold? Is it sustainable?
It's definitely working, and if you work real hard at it, it's sustainable. Now, why is it working? Because it's the great democratization of media, where you let the audience pick. So, you know, if the right-wing guy wants to put a show on there, he gets it, and if he builds an audience, he builds an audience. There's an audience for right-wing talk, obviously, right, in the country. If left-wing does it, it could be non-political. But it's just the audience, it's the invisible hand. You know, I'm back to how much I love capitalism.
Right,
okay?
Right.
It's the invisible hand of the market saying, well, I like that guy's show, and I don't like that guy's show. And so that's why it's so important to strip away the gatekeepers as a sustainable. Look, it's a hell of a lot of work. I don't want anybody to think that it's easy, right? But if you stick with it and you got a program that people like, yeah, of course. You know, we're a partner with YouTube. We make money on ads that YouTube serves. We've got our podcast that people pay for, and that brings in money. And then sponsors who say, I like your show as it is, they're welcome aboard. And then you build it. And look, here's the key to it, right? Build as you go, okay? Now, the old media has just spent so much money, and they don't have the advertising revenue to cover it anymore. So they're in a lot of trouble, okay? If you build it in the new media format, you don't have to be in trouble. You say, okay, look, I'm going to try to do this and cover my own expenses. And as soon as I cover my own expenses and I want to expand a little bit, I want to hire a producer or a second producer, well, as soon as I have the revenue in, I'm going to do that, right? So then it becomes self-sustaining.
Very well put. Very well put. How many are on your team these days?
Well, we're a great example of that. We started with everybody working for free way back in the day, right? And then we could pay a couple of people, and then finally we got up to five, and we were ecstatic that we were paying, you know, for five people full-time staff. Now we're up to eight, because the more revenue comes in, the more people we hire, because we want to make a better show.
And then the greater outreach you can do. And,
exactly.
And it becomes not only sustainable, not only self-sustaining, but self-actualizing, I guess is a good word for
right.
it.
Right. Now, we're one of the few shows that are online that is profitable, that we make money, right, overall. But soon, we're one of the few shows in old or new media that makes money, right, because
right.
their revenue base is getting eroded and their expenses are through the roof. So, in fact, this is the only way in the long run to be self-sustaining. So, but you know what? I don't know why I'm giving them tips. I guess basically because I think the old media is not going to pay attention either way. So
they're going to keep marching toward the cliff. I think I don't think you're in any real danger of anybody going, hey, you know, Cenk's got it. even though you do have it, Let me, if I could verge over into this territory for a minute, you had an experience, and this is all part of the same discussion. You had an experience with Air America,
mm-hmm.
And it's not a names kind of thing, but that strikes me as another example of that failed impulse to do things the way the right wing does it, to try to fund it the way the right wing funded it, when we don't have the structure on the left that they have, we don't have the authoritarianism on the left that they have. Is there any possibility of ever building something that goes into the public airwaves like they tried to do without crashing and burning like they did?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, but you have to do it in the new way, not the old way. I mean, they tried to structure it as an old media organization where they come in and they spend a lot of money and then hope that they're going to make it back in ad revenue eventually. It was just a bad strategy from the get-go. I mean, I love that they existed, and they started a lot of shows, and those shows wound up having an effect in the country. I mean, look at the Air America alumni, right?
Yeah, Rachel.
Rachel Maddow, Al Franken, who's now a senator, obviously, Us Online, Tom Hartman, who's got a great radio program, and the list goes on, right? So they just went about it the wrong way. There's just not that much money in radio. So if you're going to start out as a smaller set of shows, which is what they were as a network, and try to get enough money from that revenue at a small station on new shows to cover your cost, the tremendous cost that they had in setting it up, it's just not going to match up. You're going to run out of money before you finally get to the point where you're making enough money. And by that point, all of radio might have gone under anyway.
And that's one of the things, Cenk, that has always fascinated me. By no means am I anything approaching an accountant. My fingers, you know. But if you listen to right-wing radio and you pay attention to the ad breaks and you listen to the national avails for a Rush Limbaugh or a Beck or a Hannity or any of those clowns, you will hear almost uniformly the same thing. You will hear ads for vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls. Swedish mattresses based on a foam developed by NASA, herbal baldness remedies, and buy gold now. There's never been a better time to buy gold. Gold is your best investment. Gold's your best hedge against inflation. Buy gold now, followed by an ad offering to buy people's gold teeth. With all of that there, and then you read stories about how Limbaugh has just been signed to a $40 million a year deal, you know, the $400 million man. It is physically impossible to sell enough vacuum cleaners, picking up enough bowling balls, landing on enough Swedish mattresses to pay not just him, but all of the executive staff that exists around him inside Premier Radio Networks. It is physically impossible to do that. So I guess my question is, am I just overly paranoid in thinking that the right wing is much better at sliding a little money under the table to keep all this stuff going than we have ever contemplated being so far?
Well, yes and no. I would be surprised if some right wing corporations are secretly funneling money to Limbaugh, even though the show is not profitable. I would be surprised. Now, having said that, is Rush Limbaugh, is that contract make sense? No, it doesn't. You're not alone in thinking that. There's a lot of smart people in the industry who think they way overpaid him. They're not going to make that money back.
But it's not just him. It's the money. It's the money that's going to Hannity. It's the money that's going to Beck. It's the money that's going. You know, look, Beck's TV program running on Fox in England doesn't even have any sponsors anymore.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And so,
overall. Are the corporate entities happy to give money to Fox News? Yes, because they pushed the corporate agenda. Now, Fox News has lost the sponsors to Glenn Beck's program. So that's an issue for them in keeping on Glenn in the long term. But overall, they love the pro-corporate message that Glenn is putting out there. So Roger Ailes, when he goes to hire somebody, he hires Glenn Beck. Even though he's losing money in the short term on his program, he's making money in the long term through all those corporate sponsorships, and I think that's what you're referring to.
Yes, exactly.
So that's how it works.
That's it. It makes my head swim just to think about it. From the other direction, Cenk. When the other thing that the right wing is very good at is, let's say a florist advertises on a liberal program, and the liberal host says, you know, George Bush is bad. The right wing has a very, very good army who will take marching orders and call that florist and say, I'm never buying another flyer from you. That you get off that. Have you experienced any of that kind of stuff, that sort of negative economic pressure?
Not really, not yet. I'm sure it'll come one day, but generally our sponsors understand the program we do, and they're perfectly comfortable with it. And if they're not, I believe in the Ben Franklin model, which is... Somebody, he used to run a paper out of Philadelphia,
right.
and they came to him, an advertiser did, and said, look, we're going to pay you a lot of money, but he thought it was bunk, it was, you know, snake oil.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, give me a week to think about it. He went home, slept on the floor for a week, ate only bread, drank only water, came back and said, no, I'm all right, I can do that. No thank you on your ads. Okay, so we believe in that model. I didn't make a lot of money. I still don't make a lot of money, and I'm fine. Okay? So I don't need the big money if it's going to compromise
what?
Us.
You don't want the $40 million, the OxyContin Jones, and the 26,000-square-foot mansion with only a cat living with you?
What's
the matter with you?
Well, let me be clear. I do want the $40 million, but I'm not going to sell my soul to get it. Okay? So if it comes naturally and they're comfortable with the show, God bless. If they're not, then I'm okay.
Well, what have, let me ask as we wrap up, Cenk, what have you been? I know you were talking up here. You're a featured speaker here at AFN this year. What topics have you been working here in the sessions?
That's a great question, because I thought we had a really interesting panel discussion today, and it was about how holding Democrats accountable, and how do you do that? And I am enormously disillusioned with Democrats, and including President Obama.
Yeah, me too.
And the way you hold them accountable is you go after them. That's politics 101. And so we're gonna start a new PAC, and we're gonna raise money to specifically run ads explaining why politicians vote the way they do. It's based on the money that they take. And we're not going to just do it against Republicans. We're definitely going to do it against Democrats, because they're both bought. And, you know, we had a little debate on the panel of how bought are the Democrats, you know.
Oh, I come from a state where I can tell you the Democrats are real bought.
Yeah. So, you know, somebody thinks only 20% of them are bought. I think 20% of them are honest. I think only 10% of them are honest. That's the debate. Okay. But the great majority. And it's, you know why? You got to understand the incentives. It's just, it's human nature. I'm not blaming them, and I'm not blaming the corporations for trying to buy them. It makes sense. You work for the people who pay you.
It's like blaming a snake for having fangs.
Right. And politicians are natural pleasers, and if somebody gives them money, they will please them. Right? And so that's why we need, I think,
I think there's another name for that business.
Yeah. I didn't say anything. I don't
I know.
Know.
No.
So, no, look, the bottom line is the most important issue is campaign finance reform. Because if you don't change the way the politicians are funded, you're going to lose on every issue. Okay, so you got to get the underlying structure changed. Otherwise, we're never going to win.
Well, I think we're going to have an interesting this evening, I should think. We'll have an interesting little bit of data to suggest whether or not there's enough of a groundswell with bought politicians to actually get them out of office. If Bill Halter wins his runoff against Blanche Walmart Lincoln in Arkansas, we will indeed have a barometric reading, don't you think?
Yeah, that's a great step forward. And now, you know, I'm saying. I want to vote against Blanche Lincoln. I think she's as bought as it gets on the Democratic side. I just wonder, given the same incentive system, how long before Bill Halter catches the virus?
Exactly.
You know,
and that's where it logically leads.
Right, and so that's why you got to change the system so that the new guys don't catch the virus.
Because all the new guys are not Jimmy Stewart, and it doesn't work out the way that movie ends.
Exactly. And look, we're fighting it every way. I want to raise money, and it's not a right-wing or a left-wing position. I want to go back to ideological debates with the right-wing, but they don't like their politicians being bought either. And I also invite them to our protests we're doing on Wednesday. We're going to the Treasury Department. We're protesting against Democratic Treasury Secretary. They should be all over that protest saying, hey, look, we want our $13 billion back from Goldman Sachs. You paid them off on a bet. They should have never got that money from taxpayers. They made the bet with AIG. Why the hell did the taxpayers pay that bet?
Right.
And they said they didn't need it at one point. Fantastic. We'll take it back.
Yeah, call the note.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to do on Wednesday at the Treasury Department. We're going to get everybody to go. At 1:30, right in front on 15th and Pennsylvania. Everybody down here is heading down there. We got a lot of groups involved. I'm inviting everybody, not just left-wingers, but right-wingers, centrists, because is a right-winger going to tell me, no, I don't want my money back from Goldman Sachs. I think it's better in Goldman Sachs' hands. No,
right, so
it's our money.
Right, so at that point, they give up the right to call themselves fiscal conservatives.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to help with the budget? Let's start with $13 billion from Goldman Sachs.
That's a nice chunk of change.
Yeah.
Cenk Uygur, thank you very much, my friend. It's a real pleasure having this conversation with you.
Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
All right.
Best of luck with the protest.
Thank you.
From the Young Turks, Cenk Uygur, and a conversation that I've been looking forward to since I got here and found out Cenk was going to be on my schedule. That was a wonderful and engaging bit of conversation. We are coming up on the bottom of the hour and halfway through this live broadcast from the America's Future Now conference at the Omnishore Hotel in Washington, D.C. You are, of course, listening to The Horn, America's liberal voice. And you know what? If I stop thinking about that stupid camera over there, maybe I'll stop being so intimidated by it. Hey, look, Chenk's used to being looked at by a camera. It can happen. It can happen. Nah, I still don't like it. I don't like the camera. Come on. Face made for radio, please. We're at the halfway point and waiting to see where our next guest is in the course of our conversations. We will be hearing next, I hope, from Clyde Prestowitz, the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. Mr. Prestowitz goes all the way back into the Reagan administration, and he is very much a one of the things that you're going to find out, whether you were listening to Chenk saying, you know, I started out a Republican, or Scott Paul talking about the fact that there were people who worked in the Reagan administration who are looking at the direction this country is taking, and even they are horrified. You know, this is it's rather surprising to see the sea changes that are taking place in this country, and I would imagine that Clyde Prestowitz is one of those folks. We will find out a little bit more. Among other things, he headed the U.S. negotiations with Japan when he was in the Reagan administration. It was negotiations with Japan, Europe, Southeast Asia, and Latin America. The first U.S. trade mission to China was led by Mr. Prestowitz. So he has had, pardon the slurpy noises, there's no mute button or anything. Hey, this is live. He has led a fascinating career. Among other things, he was vice chairman of President Clinton's Commission on Trade and Investment in the Asia-Pacific region, as well as a member of the advisory board of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. So his experiences, I would think, will be quite fascinating, because those are places that we've had considerable concern over the years. Pardon me a moment. Yeah, see, I can on the radio. I can mute that, and you don't know that I just cleared my throat. But the camera just saw me do it. If you want to see these horrifying, these truly horrifying videos, these horrifying video images, live as it happens, you can go to ustream.tv and look up the horn. And a reminder, of course, all this doesn't end. When my 3 hours ends at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we will continue onward with the Rick Smith Show, picking up where I leave off. And Mr. Prestowitz is here with us now. How do, sir?
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, sir. Yeah. I'm Bob Kincaid. Welcome to the Horn, America's liberal voice. I'm glad you had time for a conversation with us today. I've already told folks basically what your background is, how you served not only in the Reagan administration but in the Clinton administration as well, and that you are now president of the Economic Strategy Institute. What was the motivating force behind the creation of the ESI?
My fear that the U.S. economy was on a downward slope, that we were uncompetitive, becoming increasingly uncompetitive. It looked to me like every single day the wealth-producing capacity of the U.S. was eroding, moving to Asia, not just in the low-tech commodity areas, but in high-tech and R&D, and it just seemed to me that we were on an unsustainable path.
Well, given the fact, given your past and your past experience, negotiating trade-related issues in the Pacific Rim, did you have a philosophic change, or is it a matter of things have gone off the rails in terms of how we address trade issues in those countries?
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't have a philosophic change, but what I realized was that the assumptions driving U.S. trade and globalization policy were simply at odds with the reality of the situation. It was kind of like we were playing baseball, and we assumed that the Japanese and the Koreans and the Taiwanese and the Chinese were also playing baseball. But they weren't playing baseball. They were playing football. And when I say that, what we were playing was what we call free trade. And what the other guys were playing, you might call mercantilism. But we assumed that they were playing free trade. And because our assumptions were false, we kept making the wrong agreements.
But they were happy to make noises like they were playing free trade, so long as it would meet their goals?
Yes, and but even, I mean, in a way worse than that, the international rules are really very loose. We keep in the U.S. talk about enforcing trade agreements. The problem is not that that we're not enforcing trade agreements. The problem is that the trade agreements don't really address the fundamental problems. And so our trading partners are able to comply with the trade rules and still operate in ways that undermine our competitiveness and wealth.
So under those circumstances as you describe them, Mr. Prestowitz, what is the way forward I assume you would agree that what we are in is a mess.
Right, absolutely.
What is the way forward or the way out? Do we stop talking about these what seems to me to be a failed notion of free trade when we need to be talking about fair trade, or do we just recognize that the other side's playing football and we better learn how to?
I think all of the above in a way. I mean, I think what needs to be done is we need to begin to think about, worry about ourselves. In the recent months, Secretary of the Treasury Geithner has been to China, he's been to Europe, and he's been lecturing the Chinese, telling them they have to consume more, been lecturing the Germans, telling them they have to consume more. They're not going to. This is a waste of his time, waste of his breath.
And isn't the idea of the consumer culture as it was conceived coming out of the Second World War, hasn't that sort of reached it's nadir in a way? I mean, how much of the planet can we consume before the planet disappears?
Well, you got it right, and particularly in the U.S. I mean, we're kind of at a point of consumption where you just can't go any further. And the funny thing is that we're telling the Germans and the Chinese to kind of come our way, and they're looking at us and they're saying, well, wait a minute, we don't want to be like you guys. This is a waste of time. And I think what we need to do is to focus on revitalizing our competitive base. And that means that I would launch a major infrastructure upgrading in the U.S. We have the slowest trains. We have the slowest internet. We have the least reliable cell phone system. We got to go for the best, at least equal the best worldwide in our basic infrastructure. The U.S. dollar is 40% overvalued. That means overvalued. That means that when Chinese products come into the U.S., they cost 40% less than they should. It means when U.S. products go to China, they cost 40% more than they should.
Is that partially a function of the machinations of the yuan?
Well, the Chinese government intervenes in currency markets. They buy the dollar every day in order to keep the dollar strong, to keep it overvalued. So it's a kind of a subsidy to their exports and a tariff on our exports.
Doesn't that mark us as somewhat of a hog being fattened for the slaughter?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we're a patsy in this, and we need to stop it.
I mean, the condemned ate heartily, you know?
Exactly. No, we need to stop this. This is one of the major things I think the president ought to be doing. But, I mean, let me give you another example. President Obama was in China in November, and he had a press conference with President Hu Jintao in which he said that the United States would assist China in developing a new commercial jetliner. Now, you know, jetliners are one of the few things that we Americans export to China.
And still make rather well.
Yeah, and the president is saying, oh, we'll help you make a jetliner to, you know, put us out of business. This is a mentality that has characterized all of our top leaders for the last 30, 40 years. They don't understand.
So are you suggesting that this really is not a problem of being a Democrat or a Republican?
No.
This is a problem of...
This is bipartisan. You can have total bipartisanship here. The Democrats and the Republicans act exactly the same on globalization issues. Ronald Reagan, George Bush the first, Bill Clinton, George Bush the second, and Barack Obama. There's not a difference between them on the global trade and international issues.
So when you go and you talk to somebody who's one of these persisting globalists, or persistent free traders, do they just look at you like you're nuts?
They see me as evil.
I'm not being rude.
No, they see me as evil.
You're evil?
Well, they characterize me that way. Characterized as a protectionist or a corporate statist or something like that. But the problem, the reality is that I have the facts and the truth on my side. The fact of the matter is that the theories that underpin our trade policy are just wrong, demonstrably wrong, and we need to change them. We need to change the policies.
Where does the history of this economic theory come from? How did it took hold in this country seemingly like kudzu climbing over phone poles in the South, so that you can't say that there are certain governmental circles now where you can't say anything bad about globalization without running afoul of some sort of religious heresy.
There's a lot of truth in that, and it's funny because between about 1815 and 1950, the United States ran its economy pretty much the way China runs its economy today. We had high protective tariffs, we had industrial policies, we had close cooperation between government and industry, and our target was to catch up and to beat the Brits. We wanted to be the best in the world in industry and technology, and we got there. But then in the 1950s, having become number one and having become the world hegemon, we actually began to act a lot like the Brits had before. And in particular, we adopted...
That we could throw crumbs to the world and...
Yeah, in particular, we adopted a very simplistic notion of free trade, really an 18th, 19th century notion of free trade based on the writings of Adam Smith and David Ricardo. When Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, when Ricardo wrote about trade and comparative advantage, those were important writings, but they were writings that took place at a particular time.
They were products of their culture and their
era. Right, yeah. And what one thing that really they missed or didn't incorporate is the notion of economies of scale. That the more you produce of something, the lower the cost might get. That fact is not incorporated in much of the economic theory that underlines our trade policies.
Well, so, I asked a question of Scott Paul earlier in regard to manufacturing.
Yeah, you keep funny company, huh?
Yeah. but does some of this go back to the groundings of the hateful economic thought of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, sacrifice all in the name of the corporate good?
Yeah, you have two things. The Chicago School certainly developed, rationalized, justified the notion that the market is self-adjusting, self-optimizing, let the market work. So total laissez-faire, total deregulation was the thrust of the Chicago School, and that's an important piece here. But along with that has been the notion of comparative advantage free trade, the notion that trade is always a win-win proposition. And even if your trading partner puts rocks in his harbor so you can't get your ships in there and he won't accept your goods, you should still keep your market open because that's under the theory, that is supposed to be better, that if you close your market and respond to him.
Why?
Well, because the assumption of that theory is that you have perfectly competitive markets, that you do not have cross-border flows of technology or capital. The assumptions are crazy.
This is all theory based upon no real world experience
exactly.
whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
Then.
Precisely.
It reminds me of an old joke that a buddy of mine who was an economist used to tell. He said a civil engineer and a mechanical engineer and an economist are stranded on a desert island, and they're trying to figure out strategies for survival, and lo and behold, a crate of foodstuffs, canned goods that have washed overboard from some freighter, washes up on the beach, and so the two engineers set about, they all agree that they're all going to work on how to get the cans open so they can eat. And the mechanical, the civil engineer comes up with a means whereby, you know, he's going to get a bird, they're going to drop a rock. The mechanical engineer comes up with a machine that's based on coconut shells and pulleys and stuff like that. And they ask the economist, what was your theory? And he says, assume a can opener.
Assume a can opener, exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Good. That's what economists tell
that's him. That's where it is.
Yeah. I know this is a bit more of an esoteric question, but how do theories that have not been tested by any stretch of the imagination in reality, how do they get the traction that they get so that they can come in and wreck an entire country like globalization and so-called free trade have done the United States?
There are three factors. One is that top positions dealing with economic policy are typically filled by economists. New president comes to town, he needs a chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors, he needs a Treasury Secretary, so he tends to put economists in these positions. Economists typically are very bright guys, they have PhDs, they don't live in the real world. But they get into these top positions. Second issue is that...
In other words, he could do just as well with bass players?
Well, I mean, sometimes maybe.
Sometimes the bass player may be ahead of the game.
The second factor here is that the U.S. Wants to play the great political games. We want bases. We have troops in 800 bases around the world. We're moving these troops around. We're involved in wars. We need help on dealing with North Korea. We want to put sanctions on the Iranians. And we're willing to trade economic concessions to get these political objectives. So, for example, take the case of Japan. We have, over the years, transferred enormous amounts of technology to Japan, essentially in return for using Japanese bases, for having our Navy based in Yokosuka, for having our Marines based in Okinawa. And we rationalize that concession by saying, hey, it's free trade, it's a win-win.
But when you use the word rationalize, you mean it in the same sense that psychologists and psychiatrists use
yes.
rationalize, insofar as it's a phony construct made to feel the made to make the person who's making the assertion feel better.
No, exactly. And the person who's making the assertion doesn't necessarily realize it's a phony construct, which is why it feels so good, because there's no guilt.
Hmm. That's like fat-free ice cream or something.
Exactly. So pay the piper in the end.
But I keep hearing as a sort of common thread running through a lot of the conversations I'm having here, Mr. Prestowitz, that trying to get these notions through to the Obama administration has a lot of the same negative characteristics of beating one's head against a brick wall. Is that where this stands? Are they committed globalists, devil-may-care, and come-on-man?
Well, I mean, many of them are. The Obama administration is divided a bit within itself. I mean, I've been involved in discussions at the White House in which you had the very conventional views expressed, and then in which you've also had some more what I would call competitiveness views expressed. So there is discussion, but the predominant weight of power is with the conventional wisdom.
The globalization.
Yeah, right.
Under those circumstances, then, What is the fix? What if you?
Well,
if
you, I hate to say this, but I mean, I think that the fix. There are a lot of policy measures I could suggest. We need to deal with the overvaluation of the dollar. We need to match the investment incentives that China and other countries are offering our companies to move their production offshore. We need to upgrade the support that we provide for R&D. So I can give you a lot of programs and specifics. But the key thing is that there has to be a mentality change. There has to be a recognition, a light go on that says, whoa, this globalization, the way it's working now, is not working for us.
Hi, I'm Uncle Sam. I have a free trade problem. Hi, Uncle Sam.
It's like an alcoholic. You go to AA. AA can't help you unless you're willing to admit you got a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, if we're going to use that metaphor, Mr. Prestowitz, do we have to wait for the bottom out then? Because the people that are going to suffer on the bottom out, they're going to keep having their lobster lunches on K Street.
Right.
The suffering's going to happen on Main Street.
Hey, how well I know. And I have been raising the red flag now for about 28 years, and I keep hoping somebody will recognize my red flag, but I'm afraid that it's the bottom out.
And when you talk about the overvaluation of the dollar and things like that, where does that play in the current vogue or fad or fetish for getting all sweaty about the deficit all of a sudden? Does that dovetail somewhere?
Well, it kind of does, because the overvalued dollar exacerbates our debt.
Because we're back to being fattened up like a lamb to the slaughter.
It supercharges our imports, and it enables foreign investors to pour capital into the U.S. to fund this deficit. So as long as the foreigners will buy our debt, the deficit doesn't really matter to us. And so, we're being kind of fattened up.
That's a little disturbing. No, who am I kidding? Mr. Prestowitz, that's a lot
disturbing.
It's
very
disturbing,
yeah.
You mentioned earlier that this is all a function of wholesale horrifying bipartisanship, the kind we don't want between the two parties.
You know what it's like?
Is there a chink in the armor anywhere?
Do you remember Vietnam? And you remember we had this domino theory?
Yes.
And the best and the brightest, the elite in both Republican and Democratic
and
parties.
And if Laos fell, then Vietnam fell, and then we started closing Baskin-Robbins in the United States. Right.
And all the top guys, Republicans and Democrats, embraced that theory, right? And you know what? It took 58,000 kids to get killed before somebody said, whoa, this is not really a very good theory. And it's kind of where we are right now. With this.
And all of this is naked emperor stuff, isn't it?
All of the
little herd animals in Congress were afraid to say that the domino theory was bunk until someone stood up and said it and didn't get their head lopped off.
Yeah, exactly
it.
Right.
I'm not asking you to endorse anyone, but are there people in Congress who are pointing out the things that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, there have been for a long time. I mean, Senator Bingaman from New Mexico, he's been raising a red flag for a long time. Senator Dorgan, Senator Rockefeller. There are a lot of guys who've been on this in the Congress. But, the Congress is, even though it oversees trade policy, it doesn't run trade policy. And there are, as you know, many divisions in Congress. And this is very much a matter of an orthodox doctrine that has been adopted by our elite, both Republican and Democrat, and it's kind of a tyranny of dead ideas.
A country that engages itself in a tyranny of dead ideas is a country that's going to find
itself in trouble.
It's going to find it very, very difficult to get out of trouble.
The guy who was the Minister of Finance of Japan in 1936, Kodikio Takahashi, made a very profound statement. He said that the consequences the consequences of an economic defeat are far more difficult to reverse than those of a military defeat. We are suffering right now a massive economic defeat.
And we proved him right on both ends of his theory, did we not?
We did. Absolutely.
Clyde Prestowitz, it's been a real pleasure. I thank you very much for coming by.
My pleasure.
And best of luck in your ongoing work. I won't call it a crusade.
It is a crusade.
But someone has to keep hollering that the barn's on fire.
I'm not going to quit.
Don't.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Clyde Prestowitz from the Economic Strategies Institute, ESI. Feel free to check it out. The thing about economics is that a lot of times when you talk about economics, you will find yourself making people's eyes roll back in their heads. We managed to keep that from happening in this conversation, and it was a wonderful one. And that's the whole thing. It is not nearly as complicated as what it sounds. It is about 6 minutes before the hour, and our next guest will be coming up presently. We will be speaking with John Atlas. He's a public interest lawyer. He is also a writer and an organizer, president of the National Housing Institute. He is widely known and widely read, and most particularly, he is the author of a recent book, Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Organizing Group. He probably knows the ACORN story better than anyone else you might likely inquire of. So let's go ahead and bring on John Atlas and find out about the little what is it our dear friend Matt Osborne from Osborne Inc. osborneink.com calls it, a high-tech lynching. That's what the ACORN story was, a high-tech lynching. Mr. Atlas, come right over. I'm doing well, sir. Thank you very much. Bob Kincaid, pleasure to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you, too.
I've just been giving the Horn audience a little bit of a backgrounder on the work you did in documenting the ACORN story. Seeds of Change, the story of ACORN, America's most controversial anti-poverty organizing group. You saw how ACORN operated.
Are we on?
Yes, we are. You saw how ACORN operated. You saw what it was doing. What was it that got the right wing so utterly fulminated about it? Outside that phony baloney video, the video was just if I understand it correctly, that was a means to an end.
Yes,
they wanted ACORN out of the way, did they not?
Yes. Well, you need some context, which of course you didn't get in the mainstream media. So let me try to give some context fairly quickly. First, you have to understand that ACORN was the most effective anti-poverty group in the country. If they, in 2008, they had their combined organizations, had a budget of $100 million, 1,000 employees, 400,000 members, 38 states they were in, and they were doing winning victories for poor people, both locally and nationally, something that's very unusual. So wherever they set up a chapter, you would find them cleaning up lots, putting up stop signs, fixing whatever problems were in the neighborhood that people wanted to. But because they were a national group, they were able to win major reforms such as increasing the minimum wage, and stopping predatory lending and enforcing anti-redlining or racial discrimination laws. As a result of their victories, for decades, ACORN was under attack. Oh, I left out one important thing, voter registration. They had a state-of-the-art voter registration capacity, registering millions of poor people, young people and minorities.
Exactly, the people that the Republican Party hates it when they vote.
You got it. So, what happened? You win those victories, but you pay a price. What's the price? Well, for decades, big business, especially people who like to pay poverty wages, hated Acorn, went after him. Predatory lending operations, payday lenders, went after Acorn. The Republican Party has been going after anybody that registers black and minorities for years. The think tanks, quote think tanks, like the Manhattan Institute and the Heritage Foundation, hated Acorn because they were exploding their myth of the free market. And so this didn't, and then they, what tipped the scales was President Barack Obama getting the nomination for president. And all these, this anger that the right wing was had toward Acorn, all of a sudden got
right
a national spokesperson, John McCain, Karl Rove, Sarah Palin, and that's how they got over the radar after decades of being attacked for basically helping poor people and minorities. Does that explain
it? It does to an extent.
To an extent.
But really, is that all it took? And then James O'Keefe, I'm one of those people who actually knows the background on those phony baloney videos. And all it took was for James O'Keefe to create those little, I won't even call them videos, they were edit jobs, and get Sean Hannity to play them, at that point that was just the last crumb that was needed on the fulcrum to make it all blow up. It's that simple?
It seems a little crazy, but if there were, I would say that there was one significant event. And that had to do with the way the mainstream media played the tapes. You know that those tapes were edited, misleading.
Right, that's why I said they're not videos.
However, after those tapes were shown 24/7 on Fox, then picked up by CNN, went viral on the Internet, the New York Times reported those tapes as fact.
Yes.
The Washington Post reported those as fact. Once they gave the imprimatur to what looked like the utter incompetence of this group of, you know, African American organization, once they saw they said, well, this group is phony. We're going to cut them off. Congress cut them off, and then the foundation and the liberal supporters, and their partners in the business world, all ran for the hills. So it seemed like, how could this happen, right?
Well,
that's what triggered
it. It still does to
still
me. The idea that the people who should know better would take the word of Fox News and Hannity and O'Reilly and that little James O'Keefe creep, take all those people seriously when this organization has such an established track record of doing good for the very constituency that the Democratic Party and so-called liberals and progressives work for? It's still a little bit
mind-boggling.
Yes.
Yeah, right. In 50 years, some people may look back, maybe they'll look at my book and say, oh, what was that about? How did that happen? Because I agree with you. Now, I can only explain what I know. I can't explain more than I know. And I'm with you on that.
Well, I guess the next question is, with Acorn's demise, and that's the other shocking thing is the speed that it fell apart. I mean, it wasn't just a slow little, well, you know, we got less funding this year than we had last year. No, it organizationally speaking, it was the sudden unanticipated heart attack. We knew they had it. We knew they had a sprained ankle. We didn't expect them to drop dead of a heart attack.
Was it
that quick, or was there more attenuation in there than what I think?
It's fairly quick. But I'll give you maybe a metaphor or another example that may make sense. You know, when Toyota had its troubles.
Right.
What Toyota could do, could take out full-page ads in the New York Times, could spend millions of dollars on television trying to correct its image. They, Acorn had no capacity to do that. They never put money into help in a communication system. They were never on, you know, they probably never were on this radio program. Right?
No.
Right. So why was that? That
they
was
didn't
one
ask.
Of their faults. No, no, it's not your fault. It was their fault. You know, so Acorn had some fault, as you may not be surprised, in doing this. So they weren't good at communications.
They failed to contemplate the utter virulence of the venom that was directed
yes.
at them. They thought they were in a fair fight when they were in a fight with somebody who eye gouged and kidney punched.
Right. And they should have been, I would say, much more aggressive about having an effective communications system. You got to go on the radio. You got to go on TV. You got to go where your friends are. And then I'd add one more thing. There is no, the left is not very strong in this country. It's not in the same.
It's not very left.
It's not very left.
I mean, I know the right wing likes to talk about. Likes to talk about, you know, the left and the progressives and,
you
know, and you know, Glenn Beck, you know, thinks we eat babies. And but the fact of the matter is they are creating a straw man, at best a bete noire that doesn't exist. Honest to God, Mr. Atlas, I'm not kidding. There's no left.
That's see, and I think I was in this panel at this conference this morning, and I said there would. My guess is there was only one thing that could have saved Acorn, and that was if there was a large progressive movement that included the bloggers, the single-issue groups, groups like Acorn, you know all the groups, mm-hmm. and they had the same kind of coherence and similar strategies that the right has.
And
I think that would have been the only. And
crisis, mechanism,
that, circle
yeah.
around. Circle, yeah. circle the wagons. This is one of ours. There is no feeling about that, I think, among progressive forces.
Well, you know, one of the bloggers associated with the Horn is a good friend of mine by the name of Matt Osborne, and he worked extensively, sort of forensically reconstructing what he thinks is the original video as shot by James O'Keefe, and it's quite shocking. It's still a work in progress. But he was, you know, he was captivated by this, and as this was going down, Mr. Atlas, he was saying the same thing you just did. Why are people willing to? It was like something out of Greek tragedy, for God's sakes. Acorn was standing out there and getting pincushioned with arrows from the right, and we didn't just send the cavalry. We didn't send Band-Aids. We didn't send anything. We just sat out there and we sat there and watched Acorn and said, "Oh, isn't that too bad?"
Exactly. That's you said it better than I could. I think that's exactly what happened, and it's hard to explain. But I guess hopefully a lesson will be that we can't let this kind of thing happen again.
God, I hope it. I hope it is a lesson. I hope that our side, which I will not refer to as the left, just because we're not. I mean, really. I mean, the French have a left. The Italians have a left. The Germans have a left. The British have a left. We ain't got a left.
Yeah.
We've got. You know that. I don't know. I think we're probably better defined by who follows whom when you're down to two competitors on American Idol in this country. You know, there's a lot of committed people in this room. They are not representative of, and I mean that as no insult, but not representative of the American public as a whole.
I think that's right.
They just aren't.
I think that's right. I noticed that the concerns of working people and ordinary people are often neglected by so-called progressive organizations, the bread and butter issues. By the way, and that's why Acorn was so successful. Acorn not only fought the big battles, as I mentioned, fighting the minimum wage, registering millions of people to vote, But they also, when they were in your community, they were cleaning up those rundown lots.
Yeah.
They were putting up the, they were getting the city to put up the stop signs. They were getting those abandoned buildings and turning them into livable apartments. Whatever needed to be done in the neighborhood. It's a very fascinating group.
Absolutely. And they were doing, and this cannot be overemphasized, Mr. Atlas, they were doing good work.
Exactly.
I mean, it can be characterized that simply. And I guess the outflow question from that is, given the fact that Acorn was doing good work, what happened? What happened? Because they were saving people from in the housing crisis. They were saving people from losing their homes. They were open and effective advocates for a number of issues relating to poor and working class people. What happened to their constituency? Acorn's gone, and that story is sad and sorry. But if you want to talk about the real horror, what happened to the people that were more or less left up in the air, and where Acorn had been there underneath them with the tarp to catch them?
Yeah,
what happened to them when they hit ground?
There's no. You're absolutely correct. This is a national disgrace. That is the only way you can put this. It's a national disgrace. It's a national disgrace that Democrats would reinforce what Fox News would do. Beck, Bachman, Limbo, and go along with effectively stereotyping this group that was so important to the lives of low-income people, helping them get homes, vote, and pay their taxes. But I will say one thing. First, your listeners ought to know that Acorn will, not in the form of Acorn, but new groups are forming, state by state, independent, not linked, not associated with Acorn, but using Acorn's tactics and models and the stuff they work, and then getting rid of the stuff that didn't work. So they actually learn.
Well, do you think they'll, if that's the case and there is a reinvention in place, Do you think maybe they'll take a little bit more, be a little more serious about taking their communications as not just a luxury, but something that is an absolute necessity to their ongoing survival?
All I can say is I think they will, because I think they've learned their lesson about what works and what doesn't work in this,
and with all this
era
having,
of America.
But with all this having been said, Mr. Atlas, how long will it take them to build the structure that Acorn had? I mean, is this a matter of rebuilding a city after it's been burned to the ground, or is this a little bit of urban? Is this a little bit of renovation?
I think it's more in between. It's not quite utter destruction, but it's not simple renovation. But I think there's enough people who care about the kind of work that they were doing and know that we have somebody has to do that in America, so that they will be at least. That's what I am learned so far.
Well, John Atlas, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation, as have so many of these. But I'm glad I had the chance to talk with you, because putting a little bit of meat on the bones of the of what Matt Osborne calls a high-tech lynching of Acorn is so important, because you know what? The right is never satisfied. They did it. They don't feel like it's mission accomplished with Acorn. They feel like they've proven something. They took down Acorn. Who's next? You know, just to the same extent that they that Glenn Beck, for instance, succeeded in running a good and noble and decent man like Van Jones out of the Obama administration.
Exactly.
You know, that doesn't give the right wing doesn't rest on its laurels. It doesn't declare time out for cocktails and celebrations and pass around the champagne. They say, look what we did. We are emboldened. We are empowered. And let's find the next victim.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought it was so important to write a book like this, so that there is a true story about this, about what happened to Acorn, and that hopefully...
Do you have a support website for the book?
I have a Facebook. And I do have a website that is associated with the National Housing Institute, because
okay.
I'm the president
right.
of that. But we're going to try to do everything that we're supposed to do to get that out.
Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, is readily available right now at booksellers nationwide, online, however one.
Well, at this point, it's the best place to get it is on Amazon. It won't be in the bookstores until another couple of weeks.
Okay, well, great. So at Amazon, then. John Atlas, again, thank you very much.
And thank you for having me.
I appreciate the hard work you did in pulling this story together, because it's a story that should not be forgotten, without a doubt, should not be forgotten. John Atlas, thank you very kindly.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And that brings us, we're at about 13 minutes past the hour, and this is 2 hours and 13 minutes of rock-solid, continuous broadcasting without a break. And what I'd like to do right now, things didn't work out so well when I cut the stream yesterday, so I'm not going to cut the stream, but I am going to take a brief break and come back for our 2:30 conversation with Angela Blackwell, which I'm sure you will find equally equally engaging. She has a fascinating book out, and I think we'll have a conversation that will be quite meaningful. You are listening to, so I'm not going to kill the stream or anything. Not going to. Well, I don't know what. Nah, I'm not going to play any music. We'll just go dark for a few minutes. We'll go dark and come back to, and I'm putting the lens cap on the video camera too, okay? Are we square about that? I'm going to go, we'll go dark for a little bit and come back at about half past the hour and wrap up my portion of the program. And Rick Smith is sitting here chomping at the bit to get it all fired up and go after it. Go after it at 3 p.m., all right, Eastern Daylight Time. You're listening to live continuing coverage of the America's Future Now Conference, live from the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C., the annual meeting of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. All of this coverage, of course, being brought to you by the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. And we are back live at the America's Future Now conference at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. on a beautiful, beautiful 8th day of June, 2010. And I'll tell you what we're going to do. You know, ordinarily the show is 3 hours and stuff. But we've got Rick Smith's show coming up here. And rather than me trying to engineer on the fly, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring the show to a close for my portion of the program. Rick and the Rick Smith Show will begin promptly at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And for and by the way, just a couple of program reminders. For those of you who would like to see the Ustream broadcast, it really is quite simple. You go to ustream.tv. That's the letter U, STREAM.TV, and simply search and then bookmark The Horn, T-H-E, capital H, capital O, capital R, capital N. No periods, no dots, no nothing. The Horn. And you'll be able to see the live broadcast. So that's how that works. And for those of you listening at home who would like to see why it is that Bob Kincaid constantly says, I have a face made for radio, you will find out by the broadcast will be up as a recording as soon as Rick Smith's show ends, a little 5:30, 6 o'clock, something like that. And it'll be available for later viewing. So that's how all of that works. I hope that clears up any confusions or misconceptions. Betsy, I'm looking at a chat from Betsy. I don't know if that's the I don't know if that's the link or not. I mean, our channel is simply called The Horn. T-H-E, capital H, capital O, capital R, capital N. The Horn. If you want to watch, we are certainly broadcasting live right now. So that's that is where we presently stand. This has all been quite the experience, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. By the way, Rick, do you have your itinerary for today handy? Yes. Rick has a very full schedule himself, including Lee Ferris, Alex Zajcik, Ron Ruggiero, and Representative Jan Schakowsky. And probably the high point of Rick's schedule this afternoon will be a conversation with United Steelworkers President Leo Girard. I'm sure that will be a fascinating conversation. I'll enjoy being here to sort of work the technical side of it. I'll take my host hat off and put on my tech guy hat. Let's see. No, we're not off air. We are not off air. We are broadcasting. We are really, really broadcasting on Ustream. It's all there. It's there right now. It is quite live. So hard to. There are viewers there, but apparently people are having a hard time finding it. Did you find it, Rick? Have you got it?
It's The Horn, one word.
Yeah, that's what I keep telling people. The Horn. T-H-E, capital H, capital O, capital R, capital N, The Horn.
The Horn, one word.
Yeah, The Horn, one word. Right, okay. So you could, oh, look, people are finding it, it would appear. But anyway, I'm going to knock off, and what you're going to see on Ustream here for the next few minutes is a shot of the ceiling, and we will crank it up and get going again in about a half an hour. With the Rick Smith Show live from the America's Future Now conference in Washington, D.C. So thanks for joining in. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations as much as I have. And remember, another program note, John Fox will be filling in for me this evening in my regular slot from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., as he did admirably and capably last night as well. He'll also be covering Wednesday into the bargain, and I really, really appreciate John jumping into the breach and making sure there's content and programming there in that segment. It's ever so important and ever so much appreciated. So thanks, everybody. Do remember, please, that the Horn is listener-supported. If you want to be a part of the merry band of folks who make sure that there is a Horn, that live and liberal conversation is out there for anyone who wants it, whether it be in podcast or archive form or in live form, go to the Contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com, and there's a PayPal button there as well as a snail mail address so that you can be part of what's going on here and part of the reinvention of media in the 21st century, which is what the Horn is all about. So have a great afternoon, and you'll be hearing from Rick Smith shortly. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to the Horn.